right. A couple of things about Thomas as we begin. You should be looking at page 16 in your material, second half of the page. We do not have a lot of information on him. We sometimes call him Doubting Thomas. That story is found in John 20, and I would like to read that again as we study him tonight. What you'll notice if you're looking at the material is that we have three stories from the life of Thomas in the Bible. They only occur in John's Gospel. We've mentioned that over and over again. We're really thankful for John's work. And what we've sort of labeled Thomas, and I wanted this to be mild but still the point, we call him the slight pessimist. In the first two cases of Thomas, John chapter 11 and John chapter 14, it's not that he sinned. It may not even be that he said the worst thing or even the wrong thing. But with lots of optimism around him, he was one of those people who kind of clung on to the hardest part or the biggest sacrifice or maybe the worst possible outcome. This is not a symptom of a lack of Christianity, but it might be a little symptom of a lack of good old-fashioned hope. Optimism and hope kind of go hand in hand, that things will work out. So we studied in John chapter 11, where they told Jesus, if you go back to that region, you'll die. And Jesus answered them in two ways. One, I will not be dying today. And two, when I get there, I'll even raise somebody from the dead. That was a really great response. And yet at the end of that, Thomas in John 11 said, let us go so that we may die with him. And we talked about that on Sunday. That was a courageous thing to say, but it kind of missed the point. The point is, we're not going to die today, and we're going to raise people from the dead. And so that's where he starts to get that name, as somebody who sees the heaviest of the matter. And the reason we're revisiting this tonight is I think this is important for Christians to think about. I know we don't have a lot of people who are blasphemers in the room or people who are all-out doubters or hypocrites, but maybe we have people who share some of the milder issues that the apostles faced, and that's worth looking at also, like pessimism, like someone who sees what's wrongest in a situation and sort of imagines the worst outcomes. Kind of seemed to be something we saw in Thomas a little bit. In John 14 was the second case. In John 14, Jesus had told them who he was. He had told them he was going to heaven. He had told them about the Father. And Thomas says, we don't know where you're going. How do we know the way? Well, he wasn't lying. I mean, Thomas really didn't have a clear picture. But there's so many more optimistic ways to say that. Like, we know you'll show us the way. We believe in you. Or, I'm sure that we'll find our way because you're our leader. But instead, he kind of looked at it as the worst case. Like, we don't know what we're doing. And we don't know what's going to happen next. So a little bit of that pessimism. Now, how does that show up in John 20, in our third case? How does this attitude show up in John 20 when finally Thomas is able to see Jesus face to face? What do you see? He wanted more proof. Now, I kind of defended him a little bit the other day. Why does Thomas deserve at least a little bit of defense here in John 20? How is his situation different from the other 10 apostles? How many days? 8 days. So the others already sort of took their medicine. They all doubted. They were all hiding. Jesus appeared to them, and he chastised them for their unbelief, Mark 16. And he said, look, you need to get on board. We have work to do. And they maybe even saw the imprints, for all that we know. 8 days later, verse 26, his disciples were again inside and Thomas with them. Now, what do you think Thomas has been hearing for 8 days? Jesus is alive again. The good news, the gospel. He is alive. We saw him. It's not what we thought. It's bigger. It's better. It's spiritual. And he's been hearing good news, but something in Thomas just can't believe it. That's a pessimism manifestation. I just can't believe the good news. And so when it comes down to verse 25, before Jesus appeared, they said, we have seen the Lord. He said to them, unless I see in his hands the imprint of the nails and put my finger into the place of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Man, that's really not a great statement. It doesn't mean he's a sinful guy or his faith is completely evaporated. They were going through a terribly difficult time. But it meant that he just had trouble believing the good news. So So when Jesus comes, he says, verse 27, reach here with your finger to my hands, put your hand in my side. And then Thomas says one of the great things of the Gospels, my Lord and my God. And what is Jesus' message at the end of this for all disciples? Blessed are those who believe after they have touched my side. No. Blessed are those who believe and yet have not seen. I think optimism and hope really are two things that go hand in hand. I have this hope, this faith, this belief in what is good and what will work out. And I don't need to see and touch everything in order to believe the goodness of God. So those are a few of the stories that come together. And look, we all have this spirit in us. I think I've identified with Thomas a lot this week. I believe I'm a Christian man. I'm trying to serve the Lord. But, you know, there are just lots of situations with our faith where you can either believe it's going to work out or you can fear that it won't. You can see the best outcome, maybe even against all odds, or you just know it's not going to work out. I'm experiencing a little bit of that right now. My family and I are supposed to be going on vacation Monday morning to Florida. Anybody watching the Weather Channel? Depression 99L/ruin Chris's vacation. Barreling west by northwest. Well, there's lots of computer... Okay, there's like two computer models that give me a chance. I can barely even see that. All I can imagine is, what am I going to do? And that doesn't even matter. That's not a spiritual thing. But there's this sort of propensity in us all a little bit, some of us, to just grab onto this is probably not going to work out. You guys have heard of a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Pessimism is a self-fulfilling emotion. You almost always hit what you're aiming at. You aim for nothing, that's what you hit. And it almost always follows wherever your demeanor leads it. So, something there. In this case, he was corrected by Jesus, and he got the picture, and things worked out. And that's a good part of this to see. Yeah, he was so tough. He was questioning his fellow apostles. I don't care if you're Peter. I want to see it. And maybe that's a part of this too. You know, you just end up sort of writing everybody off until you can see it. And again, we're not giving him this terrible name. And I think he gets a bad rap as doubting Thomas. They were doubting apostles. But he did get singled out by the Lord. And I think there's something we can learn. Comment or two and we'll move on. Something over here? Oh, I saw somebody. Yes, sir.
Very emotional time, I think. Yeah. I mean, they had been through a lot.
And that's kind of the way this works. It works through emotional times. I mean, if it's something that doesn't really matter, I mean, optimism and pessimism aren't even required because we're not emotionally invested. This is an incredibly emotionally invested moment. All right, so a few things we can learn. Look at the bottom of page 16. I have a little list of 4 points there. Could just be more of Thomas seeing the whole thing as a glass half empty. However, upon seeing the proof, he is responsible for one of the best lines in all the Gospels, my Lord and my God. Thomas affirmed the deity of Jesus. Thomas moved past these hiccups and lived his life in faith and likely preached out his life, and there's some secular history here, in the India region until being martyred by a spear. But Jesus said, blessed are those who did not see and yet believe. Maybe in part Jesus is saying, blessed are the optimists, the positive, the hopeful, the faithful. Even though you just can't always know every detail about every outcome, you got to believe the best. We're not talking about blind faith. Thomas, had he believed, it wouldn't have been blind. He would have had the testimony of the apostles and an empty tomb he could have gone and looked at and probably did. We're not talking about a blind faith. We're talking about a positive faith that sees the good of God. All right, so that's my last comment on Thomas. Anything from you before we look at these other fellas? All right, look on page 17. I'm going to read here from Luke 6. And when day came, he called his disciples to him, and he chose 12 of them. This is Luke chapter 6, verses 13 and following, whom he also named as apostles. And in that list, you have James of Alphaeus and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James, who actually has two or three names. We'll talk about him in a little while. You might know him by another name, depending on the version that you're reading. And Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. So we're going through our lesson in the same order. If we knew nothing at all about these three men, let me stop there and let you fill in the rest of it. If there was no passage, and without John, we'd be missing a lot of passages on a lot of the guys. But if there was no specific verse anywhere in the Bible telling you anything about the words or actions of James of Alphaeus, Simon the Zealot, or Judas the son of James, what do you know about those three guys? Without any specifics. I know they left everything. Thank you, that was really well worded. They left everything to follow Jesus. I know that about them. What else do I know? Yeah, I know that he was the one who chose them. That's what you saw in Luke 6. There's something in them Jesus could use. I assume they weren't perfect guys, because that's the case with the other guys. What did they do in their life? What amazing things did they do, even without any specific stories? Did they work miracles? They did. They worked miracles. Did they speak in other languages? They did. Did they preach the gospel to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Jews? They did. Even without any specific information on these three guys, just by studying the passages with the plurality of the apostles, you know that these were some amazing guys. And they're worthy of respect for that. And we'll pick up a couple details if we can. Paul, do you have something to add there?
Well, what I was going to say was, from what we know about how the apostles were chosen, these guys were probably following John at the first. And they knew about him, and they were interested in God before Jesus even came on the scene.
Okay, really good point. These are probably men of faith. They're probably not highly educated men. They're Galileans. But they are men who believed, who knew the law. They're men who followed John, and they're men who left everything to follow Jesus. They saw Jesus alive. What are the prerequisites to being an apostle? Eliminates Lance and me. We saw him alive. We saw him alive again. Acts chapter 1, we saw him alive. We saw him alive again. And God, in some capacity, chose us. Now, people like to assume that that third thing is really simple. It's not that simple. But the first two things are really, really simple. You either saw Jesus alive or you didn't. You saw him alive again or you didn't. And these men did. And that's just some of what you have here in these first two paragraphs. They were, Luke 18, they left everything to follow him. Acts 2, they became terrifically important preachers of the truth. Matthew chapter 10, they had miraculous powers even before Pentecost. They saw Jesus raised from the dead. And they stood there and looked into the eyes of the Savior in Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 through 20, and they were given the Great Commission. James, the one they called the less, was given the same commission as Peter, that you would go into all the world and preach the gospel and baptize them and teach them to be disciples. So they have this level of respect. But what can we know? Well, the Bible, let's talk about James, the son of Alphaeus. The Bible mentions several men named James, so that gets complicated really, really quickly. James was perhaps the most common name among men in the Jerusalem first century age. Very common. We've already studied one or two of them. We know that one is James, the son of Zebedee. What do we know about James? Slight review tonight. What do we know about the other James, the son of Zebedee? Who's that guy? Why, he's the son of Zebedee. What else? James and John are brothers. They have an outspoken mom. What do we know? How did he die and when did he die? He was beheaded. What year was that? I can always ask that one too many questions. It's like we're married. I can always take it one question too far. Thank you. 44 AD, and that's recorded in Acts chapter 12. So James gets sort of written out of the story pretty early on, James the brother of John. But this James isn't really even in the story. I don't think I can take you anywhere outside of Acts 1 where they're listed and show you any of the activity. So when we pick up in Acts with James, and we do, right after one James dies in Acts 12, in Acts 15 we pick up with another James. And he was great. He was an elder in Jerusalem. Who is that guy? That is the most likely half-brother of Jesus, an elder in Jerusalem, and the author of... That's right, the author of the book of James. So we have two prominent James in the New Testament. Neither one of them are this guy. So he still sort of passes that criteria of a hand-picked, miracle-working apostle, but there's not much there. So we've studied the James, the son of Zebedee. We know quite a bit about James, the Lord's half-brother. He was in Jerusalem in Acts 15, wrote the book of Acts. As to our James, there are a few interesting things we may know about his lineage and family. And I have a typo here, so if you enjoy public speakers making mistakes, then tune in. Firstly, no typo here, his mother was at Christ's crucifixion and the empty tomb on Sunday. Did you know that? Open your Bibles with me to Mark chapter 15. To some degree, and I think you're going to find this interesting in a minute, to some degree, James's family, it was a family affair to follow Jesus. In Mark chapter 15, there were also some women looking on from a distance, verse 40, among whom were Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James the Less, or James the Less, and Joseph and Salome. So he's called sometimes James the Less or James the son of Alphaeus. Those rhymes, so we remember them. We'll talk about that less thing in a minute. But his mother was connected frequently, it seems, to Mary Magdalene. And when you go to chapter 16, verse 1, there they are again. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so they might come and anoint him. So his family was associated with something quite majestic, quite amazing. He and his mother both saw Jesus die and saw Jesus raised from the dead, or at least the empty tomb in that case. Now here's my mistake. It is not possible that Andrew was his brother. But it is possible that... That is interesting to me. In fact, I was reading, Paul, that book he gave me on the apostles and some presumed facts about them. Matter-of-factly states that James and Matthew, the tax collector, were brothers. A couple of things about that. It's possible, and you might want to correct that and make that Matthew right there. Look in Mark chapter 2. Mark chapter 2 and in verse 14. James is listed in Luke 6 as the son of Alphaeus. We saw that already. James of Alphaeus. In Mark chapter 2 and verse 14, as Jesus passed by, he saw Levi, or Matthew, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me," and he got up and he followed him. Well, that creates a lot of interesting questions that I'm not going to ask in class because you have no idea, because I have no idea. But how did that work? Who found Jesus first? It makes me think that maybe when Jesus walked up to that tax booth and said, "Follow me," maybe it wasn't the first time they'd ever seen each other. It's quite possible that Matthew had some understanding of Jesus, that he'd learned some things about Jesus, but he hadn't yet left his day job. You might remember that even the fishermen didn't leave the first time. When Jesus first met Peter, Andrew, James, and John at the boats, they talked and he left. He came back on another occasion and he said, "It's time to go," and they left. Maybe that's what happened with Matthew. But at some point, both of these men follow Jesus, of course, and it is probable, and again, some of the literature I read today was quite emphatically convinced. So we have definitely a family affair now, if we're right about this. We have two brothers who are servants. One was a tax collector and left, and the other may have been called the Less. Anybody met my brother Caleb? And you know what I'm going to say? He's like this tall, all right? Even though I'm older, I'd be the Less of the big brother. And it may be that he's called the Less because of his stature or something, and because these two are brothers and one was larger, one was smaller. We don't know that for sure, but that's a possibility. And then here's a third possibility. Also could be Jesus' fleshly cousin. There's some research that suggests that Mary Magdalene and the other Mary are together all the time because they're related, potentially even sisters. They gave multiple names, like part of your name might be Mary. Probably half the ladies had Mary somewhere in their name. Very possible that they were, and you can read in Mark 15 or look over in John 19, I think this is right. John 19 and verse 25. Standing by the cross were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas. Now I'm going to stretch your brain here for a second. John 19, 25, it's Jesus' mother, and she's got a sister named Mary. There's no doubt about that. It's right there. And it says, "Mother Mary, the wife of Clopas." And while it's not provable conclusively, it's very possible that Clopas Alphaeus are the same guy. I mean, there's some suggestions for that. They had surnames and second names and third names. And I mean, when your mom got mad at you, it took 10 seconds to call out your name. So there's some strong possibility there. If that's true, we're talking about a real family affair. We're not just some random tax collector. It's my cousin. Jesus went to some of his own family and said, "You, get out of there and follow me." And then they went and had a dinner with all kinds of tax collectors and sinners. I would say that in terms of confidence, I've listed them strongest confidence to least confidence. I know that James's mother was a part of the crucifixion story and the resurrection story. It is likely that his brother is Matthew, and it is possible that they're actually related to Jesus through the Marys. All right, any comments, questions, or rebuttals about that? You rebut that, and you watch how quickly I say, let's move on. This is not, Ben always says, I'm not going to die on that hill, and I'm not going to die on this one, but I do find that pretty interesting stuff. Comments? Other than passing references, James is utterly obscure. Even his nickname reflects a lack of prominence. James of Alphaeus, in some places, James the Less. In Mark 15, he's called James the Less. This Greek word means little, and perhaps he was small in stature. It could have meant that he was young in age. Since there were two James in the group, he might have been the younger of the two James, or the smaller of the two James. We don't know if it's a supplied name because of something that we see there. Some scholars suggest it had to do with his lack of prominence. I'm not really buying into that. I don't know that they'd have called him that at the time because you're going to be less prominent than the other. The more prominent, James will die first. Which one would you like to be? Less prominence is fine. I like this nickname, and this is some stuff that I just sort of garnered from reading a bit. I like this nickname because it reminds us that you don't always have to be the big guy. You know, James, that's why I opened the class with the top of the page. I mean, James the Less. Could you be given a more humble name? How about never getting, nothing you ever said got recorded in the Bible? How's that feel? You're named Less, and nothing you said survived past the week you said it. And yet still this man was hand-selected by Jesus, inspired by the Holy Spirit, brought people to Christ, sits at the right hand of God with some, or around the throne of God, I should say, with some form of thrones and judgment, just like Peter. It's not Peter and James. They're all equally blessed by the Lord. And I think that there's always a good takeaway message for the guy who's not the name, the guy who's not the most known or the most prominent. We don't label them the less, but we could read in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 about the parts of the body. Do you remember the point that Paul made about the parts of the body in 1 Corinthians chapter 12? What did he say about those thumbs and appendixes? Appendixes. Not only are they all needed, but in some cases, they may be worthy of more honor. Because when you need it, you need it. You don't need the other thing. You need it. And so there's this argument in 1 Corinthians 12 about there will be more known, there will be less known, there will be more prominent, there will be less prominent. But these are all apostles and we are all Christians. And everybody matters in the body. And sometimes you, though people five towns over may not even know your name, sometimes your activity in the church will be more important than anything any preacher ever said. You got to believe that about what this means. And James is sort of a by name definition of that, I guess. All right, that's James, the son of Alphaeus, potential cousin of Jesus, potential brother of Matthew. Any final thoughts? Okay. All right, the next one we have listed is Simon, who was called the Zealot. And that's significant. That tells us a little bit about him. Likewise, we don't have any quotations of his. We don't have any stories to read. Not even John threw in anything for us like he did with so many others. While the word zealous can have a positive connotation, sadly, that's not the case here. To call someone the zealot was not a first century compliment. The word zealot even today means a person who is fanatical and uncompromising in pursuit of their religious, political, or other ideals. We don't use the term zealot. Have you called anybody a zealot lately? Zealot. I got to tell you, just saying it is interesting. You should do it at home. Just do it at home. But it has a pierce to it, you zealot. We don't use that word today. We use other words that mean the same thing. What other words would we mean besides, let me read the definition again so we'll be clear, a person who is fanatical and uncompromising in pursuit of their religious, political, or other ideals. And I mean that negatively. What do we call? Dogmatic. Like that's any clearer. But that is what we use. We say you're being dogmatic about that. You're unbending about it. Dogmatic does not, however, connote the idea of being violent. If someone is dogmatic, it means they won't listen. They're so ingrained, but it doesn't mean that they're going to attack you. Zealot has an extra effort. And that's probably why we don't use it much today. You don't run into a lot of true religious zealots who will attack you. Think crusades. Think Jews and those who were Judaizing teachers who stoned people for their faith. Zealot. Okay, that's the idea. We don't have a lot of that today. We might call people pharisaical. I think that's our zealot compromise. And there is a little bit of violence in the first century, though we typically don't mean that. It is associated with being overly and overtly zealous for the sake of being thorough. Note that he is also called Simon the Canaanite in some versions, but that doesn't mean he's a Canaanite. If he was a Canaanite, he'd be a Gentile, and I wouldn't know what to do with that. But Canaanite has a root meaning of zealous. So when you see Simon the Canaanite, you're really seeing Simon the Zealot. The Zealots were a Jewish political party. They hated the Romans. And their goal was to overthrow, watch this, because I think you're going to see why he joined the Jesus team early on. Their goal was to overthrow Roman occupation. They advanced their agenda primarily through terrorism and acts of violence. The Zealots were extremists in every case. They were militant, violent outlaws. So why do you think in day one, Simon the Zealot wanted to follow Jesus? Say again.
Okay.
So he wanted to go because of where it was headed. Yes, ma'am? Yeah. If Jesus is what we think he is here to depose the Roman government. He is here to wage war, and he is the outcast of outcasts, and he's going to come in a militant way, and maybe early on, we don't have this story, but maybe early on that had some effect on the approach that Simon made. Now, I think you're going to observe it on page 18, but it's really interesting to see the difference in the background, and I think the point here is the background doesn't matter. That's the point. Point is, I don't care about the background. You shouldn't care about it either. But think about the background of Simon the Zealot, hated Rome, hated everybody associated with Rome, was willing to be militant and persecutory against any sympathizer of Rome, sitting at the same table with Levi. Who is Levi? He is an employee of Rome. He gathers, I know some libertarian guys who are pretty close to Simon the Zealot on this. And if you put them down with a true liberal Democrat, just bring your first aid kit. This guy probably stole from Jews to keep money for himself, which hurt the Jewish people, and to give money, even if he was an honest tax collector, to give money to the Roman government. These two guys cannot coexist in the same room, and the truth is they probably would not have. But that's the thing about the gospel, isn't it? That's the thing about the gospel. The good news, the spiritual kingdom, the purpose for it all, the unity. Jesus preached about unity in that prayer in John 17. He prayed for unity. Can you kind of get a sense of that now? You got a tax collector in the room and a zealot in the room and two high-strung brothers over here planning to destroy some city. And you got all these going on. And Jesus is saying, I just pray for unity among these guys, that they get what this really is. The more you know about him, the more you can kind of see why Jesus prayed. I see two or three hands. I'm going to start this way and work my way that direction. David?
I'm just going to make a side comment. I wonder if Jesus, my question has always been just how did he get those two guys in the same room in the first place? And then if he just kind of stood back and maybe just a little curled up smile, to see and I can't see how it's...
Yeah.
But to your point, it's just how the gospel works, that you can get these two extremes of personalities under one roof.
Yeah.
And then eventually, 3 years later, achieve just a world-changing event.
They all stood together in Acts 2. It wasn't just Peter. It wasn't just Peter and John. They all stood up together in Acts 2, and they preached the word. Remember, you don't just have a tax collector and a zealot. You have guys who've been arguing for 2.5 years on who is the greatest. You had two brothers trying to corner the market around the backs of the other guys. I mean, you had people. Let's just put it that way. They're not good or bad. They're just people with personalities and process and mistakes. And Jesus prayed for unity, and they found it in him. They had to get the picture that it was a spiritual kingdom. That's the only way you can find it. I'll just tell you that's the case. In your family and in the church, you can't get there from here unless you understand the spiritual, soul-saving, eternal nature of why we're in the room together. They got it, and then they did great work. Yes, ma'am.
He may have seen Jesus as a rebel.
Yeah.
A rebel cause.
I read something here that made me think that as well. Somebody who would hate, and I use the word hate, you know, the Roman government and want to oppose it. He heard Jesus say a couple of things he probably didn't like. When they talked about who you're going to render to and whether you would pay taxes to Caesar, what would a zealot say? At least that. And Jesus said, give them their money. This is not about that. What an interesting learning curve for a guy like this to go through. And when it says Simon the Zealot, we don't know if that was his long-term past. Maybe he had left all that behind when he followed Jesus. That's a possibility. But that's his background. These backgrounds didn't matter when they found Jesus. I thought I saw another hand in the middle and I missed it. Yeah, Paul?
It would be very interesting on the day of Pentecost to see the tax collector and the zealot standing on the stage next to each other preaching the same thing at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some power to that too, isn't it? You think about Acts chapter 2 when they said, how are these guys talking to us in other languages? They're fishermen. They're Galileans. And then you add the political differences, the social and economic differences. There was something amazing going on. And which, by the way, is how we display the power of the gospel today. People of different backgrounds, ethnicities, histories, socioeconomic differences, one family. That's powerful. Makes a big difference. All right, a couple of things at the bottom there before we get to Judas, the son of James. So here's Simon, taught to be militant, to establish Jewish reign over Rome at all costs. When he first joined Jesus, he probably believed Jesus was going to set his rule over Rome. We talked about that. Interesting that he and Matthew were from opposite backgrounds. In another life, he might have even sought to kill him. What an amazing choice for Jesus to ask this man to follow him. But there lies our lesson and our encouragement. People with passion and zeal have often wasted it on the wrong targets. And as I read that, I thought about the Apostle Paul. He was extremely zealous for his ancestral traditions. He detained and destroyed Christians. Or scorn it with the wrong emotions or the wrong actions. Jesus doesn't seek to rob us of that zeal, but refine and redirect it to the spiritual kingdom and defeated the government of Satan in people's lives. So I want you to be Simon the Zealous now, not Simon the Zealot. And that was the change that Jesus made in them. All right, final comments on this fellow. Okay. Yes, sir?
You've got to remember these, all of these men with their different personalities. The main thing that they saw the dead raised. They saw all type of miracles work. And something like that, when you see it, all of these petty differences just evaporate. I mean, they are caught up in something that is so great that it overshadows all of these differences in their personalities and subdues them. They're just following. They're amazed at what they're seeing and what they're invited to be a part of.
That's so well said. And as you say that, I can't help but think about everybody in this room, all of God's people all over the world, different everything before they became Christians. And everything you just said would apply to everybody in this room. When we know what we're a part of, and it's the most important thing, all the rest of that goes away. I think that's really well said. It could be applied both ways. All right, let's introduce our third character. Looks like we'll just get a chance to sort of touch it a bit, look at a couple of paragraphs, and then on Sunday morning we will finish, do a bit of review on these three guys, finish the study of James or Judas, and then be ready to move into the Judas on Sunday morning, Judas the betrayer. Quite a bit we'll say there. We'll introduce some stuff that's even not in the material. Okay, Judas the son of James. Looking back on page 17, this is how they were introduced in Luke's gospel. Luke is a Gentile writer. They did not always use the same words to describe these guys. That's why we kind of got into that Nathaniel Bartholomew discussion the other day. In Luke 6, it's called James of Alphaeus, also sometimes called James the Less. It's Simon who is called the Zealot. I think that's a pretty standard term. And then Judas, the son of James. But as we get into the material on page 18, this man is noted more for who he was not than who he was. We know him as not that Judas. John 14, 22. He is sometimes called the apostle with three names. He is most often called James, which means Jehovah leads, just some information behind the name. But in King James Version, Matthew 10, 3 lists him as Libius, whose surname was Thaddeus. In fact, when kids learn to list the apostles, we call him Thaddeus. So that's interesting. You could call him Judas. You could call him James, and we've got too many of those, so that's out. Or you could call him Thaddeus, which is the term that he's actually, I think, known by in terms of what we use. And maybe some of these names were given to him. James may have been assigned to him after he followed the Jehovah. This term Libius and Thaddeus means a heart child, and maybe he was assigned that because he had a childlike heart. Truth, we have no idea on that. We do not know that. But some of these names they were born with, and some of these names they were assigned based on their character. Like Barnabas, his name was changed there because of his love and kindness for others and as an encourager. All right, here's what we'll do. I see some kids just really ready to come in right now. So go ahead and take a look at John 14. He does say something in the Gospels. The other two guys didn't do that. We'll read the one thing that he said, and please be prepared to study Judas Iscariot on Sunday.